Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest bonus episode for the Rest is History Club. Tom, are you in fine fettle?
Yes, I am. I led my cricket team yesterday to a triumphant victory in your neck of the woods.
So you're at Great Chew, is that right?
Yeah, Great Chew. That's round the corner from you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very close, near Soho Farmhouse, where Harry and Meghan used to spend their their evenings.
And Jeremy Clarkson, David Beckham, you, all the stars.
David Cameron. Yeah. All the stars of 2014.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, so we won, and I'd had a crippling sports injury a few days before, which I was worried might prevent me from performing at full throttle. So I I've been very, very depressed about that.
Golly, have you?
Yeah, I was thinking, my summer's over, it's ruined, I'm injured, I'm out. And then as it turned out, I bowled six overs, lightning pace, moving it both ways, got a wicket, got their best batsman out.
I think Jason Cowley said medium pace.
Past medium, he said.
Anyway, and you were in Oxford.
So I'm very happy.
You've twice been in my neck of the woods because you were in Oxford on Saturday, weren't you?
Yeah. So I stayed the night in Oxford on Saturday because my elder daughter graduated, bless her.
She did. And you went punting, or they went punting.
Yeah, we all went punting, yeah.
My
younger daughter too, who people may remember inspired the Fashion Victims episode.
She did.
She came looking like a sinister Victorian doll or a Victorian suicide. She had a kind of terrifying, she looked very odd,
okay,
but very stylish.
Okay. And
very distinctive.
She's going to inspire another episode, isn't she? Am I not right in thinking that we are thinking about history's greatest couples?
That's right. Yes, we are. Yes, for Love Island.
A Love Island themed episode.
Yes.
If you're
history's top hunks and babes.
Yeah,
so, we'd be interested to hear your nominations for history's top hunks and babes.
Because when you kick off Love Island, you're not a couple already. That's right.
No, you've got to match up. Yeah.
You've got to couple up.
Yeah.
So we can enter anyone we want. I mean, we could enter Ramsay MacDonald.
He's not a top hunk.
No, but we could. Is that really what you want? Do you want them all to be hunks? Genuine hunks?
Well, because otherwise it's not Love Island.
So Henry V, Achilles.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Mark Antony.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's one to look forward to, isn't it? So this is the first bonus we've done since the release of our Dan Carlin episodes, which I think certainly speaking for myself, I had no idea how they were going to go. And I really, really enjoyed doing those. I thought they were a great laugh.
Yeah, they were such fun, weren't they?
He was
a nice guy.
He was a very, very, very nice guy who was very
funny.
Yeah, he was just very funny and very easy. Yeah. Very easy guests. Sometimes some guests are definitely less easy than others. But he didn't take himself too seriously. And he was also absolutely happy to join in, wasn't he?
Well, because on his podcasts, I mean, it's just him.
Yeah.
We wondered, will he be gregarious? Will he just want to sit there and talk at inordinate length about campaigns? But he couldn't have been more delightful.
But I wonder whether you agree with this or not, that sometimes there's a big difference between somebody who's an enthusiast for history, as Dan is, because Dan is a radio presenter, I think, by trade, who fascinated by history and politics. And sometimes those people are better communicators about history than academic specialists who are sort of crippled by the fear of they're like people tensing up, serving a sort of a deuce in the five-set tennis match when you can see them cramping with nerves that they're going to say the wrong thing or make a mistake or not credit the right other historian or whatever. And so they're not necessarily – they don't talk with the freedom and enthusiasm that you do. If actually your personal stake is purely, interest rather than professional.
I mean, thinking of Mary Beard, who, of course, is a brilliant communicator. An absolutely leading expert in her field, brilliant at bringing it to life. But she was reluctant to answer your question on whether Alexander the Great had defeated Julius Caesar. Wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
So maybe you have to not have a university post before you're willing to engage in.
Well, I think people are
counterfactuals comparing things from different periods. I can imagine that an academic would feel might be beneath their dignity.
I think academics definitely think it's beneath their dignity. But I think a bigger thing is that academics are actually worried about what other academics will say. So going to think about my own academic experience, when I was doing my PhD at Cambridge, we would often go to the pub after the seminar, the other PhD students, and sort of play these kind of games, you know, and that's in a sort of nerdy way. But I can remember when I was a full-time academic, a more senior figure in our department, he appeared in a TV series about the most evil men in history. And he was a...
Hitler's gold.
He was a talking head, and he was talking about King John, very much not a friend of the rest of history. And everybody in the department, you know, was whispering behind his back for months afterwards. Oh, he appeared in that terrible Channel 5 program. He said King John was one of the worst men in history. What a fool, what an idiot. And it's sort of, that's what you live with as an academic, is that, you know, everybody else is sort of, that sort of slight priggishness, I would say. Apologies to any academic listeners. But they're sort of hanging over you a little bit and makes it very difficult to just talk with freedom about things.
Something that's even more dangerous if you're an academic is to play those pub quiz machines they used to have. I remember doing that in Cambridge with a specialist in English literature.
Yeah.
And the pub quiz question came up, in which country is Hamlet set? And he went, Italy!
What?
Oh, shit! If mobile phones had been invented and I'd been filming it, I could have blackmailed him for the rest of his life over that.
What the hell did you say Italy for?
I don't know.
Oh, that's funny. I once did a pub quiz in Sheffield with my friend James Davis, who is now a medieval historian at the University of Ulster in Belfast. We won by a massive margin, despite the fact they had two rounds about soaps in which we got naught. So that tells you how well we did in the other rounds. And I knew we were going to do well when they started announcing the results of the picture round. So this was in about 2004. And the guy said, all right, now the picture round. Number one, the answer to number one was Jacques Chirac. And everybody kind of in the pub went, oh, in disbelief. And I thought, oh, we're gonna do well in this. But you know what the prize was? The prize was just vouchers for more drinks at the same pub.
That's all right, isn't it?
Well, I just didn't want to go back to that pub.
Why not? You could have just kept winning.
I suppose.
You could have won so big that you could have drunk the pub dry.
I could have done, but that would have affected my ability to compete in future quizzes.
I suppose that's true. Anyway, listen, we're getting massively off the piste that is history's biggest questions. We've got some questions. So Stephen Clark, does Dan Cullen have any ambitions to join the US Senate? He'd be an absolute champion at the filibuster. He would.
He would. He absolutely would.
He was very well behaved, wasn't he, in terms of length with us?
Yeah.
And he gave concise
answers. Yeah, yep. he was very well behaved.
The two guests who've absolutely, you know, unstoppable, Willie Dalrymple and Stephen Fry.
Well, Stephen Fry, we didn't speak from the second minute of that podcast till the 57th minute or so. I mean, he just spoke. That was incredible. I mean, I'd sort of look at my watch and 20 minutes would have gone by. Since one of us had last spoken.
Yeah, so Dan was much better behaved.
He was.
Andy and Brum, listening to discussion about dropping the atomic bomb on Japan, have you read Hell to Pay by DM Gian Greco? No, I haven't. Have you?
No, but I know what it says.
A book which you read open-mouthed and swear regularly at the size of the numbers involved in the issues the invasions of Japan were going to face. Dropping the bombs was the best outcome for both sides.
So this is still a controversial issue because there are still some people who think dropping the atom bomb is immoral. I think the most historians, not all, but most historians who've written about this would say the alternatives were either blockading Japan, trying to starve it into surrender, which would have taken a very long time and would have obviously involved starving a lot of Japanese civilians to death, or launching an amphibious invasion, which are always, as your brother will tell you, Tom, always enormously tricky, very bloody. The Americans had just seen the Japanese basically fight to the last man on Okinawa. So they knew that basically it would be incredibly bloody. They also knew the Japanese had basically said, if Allied troops set foot in the homeland, in our homeland, we will start to execute our prisoners. So damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I think Harry Truman at the time, new president, obviously, kind of a bit out of his depth. I think he felt, understandably, you know, we've gone through all this trouble developing this weapon. And if I don't use it now, A, what was the point? But B, the public will never forgive me if we go on to incur half a million casualties or whatever it might be. So it was an impossible situation. I think the truth of the matter is that most people probably would have dropped the bomb, but they might well have had sleepless nights about it afterwards. Yeah. Anyway.
Quite a lot of reaction to the to Dan's argument that it was the Kaiser who was the most influential leader of the 20th century. So Harold Stassen proposing Nicholas II. Boll.
Boll.
he nominates Bismarck.
Wow.
Does that count?
Well, he's basically saying no German unification, no World War One, no the rest. But I think German unification would have happened, Bismarck or no Bismarck.
Yeah, but also, Dominic, your question. I mean, the most influential leader of the 20th century presumably means you have to live in the 20th
yeah,
century.
Yeah, I think so. Otherwise, you're going to... Otherwise, it's just an excuse to let you pick Jesus again, Tom, or Mohammed.
yeah.
So at some stage, when we're really desperate for material, I found the other day an exam paper answer that I wrote when I was 13. In which I had to list, I think it's the 20 most important people in British history.
At one point, I think when we were drunk, we talked about doing the 100 most important.
No, I was a sober, respected historian when we talked about that, and I'm still absolutely wedded to it.
We could do that next year, couldn't we, perhaps? That might be fun.
We will have to sit down and work out the 100 most important people in world history, and we'll do a big countdown. Now, the danger for me, as Restless History Club members will know, is that some of those people may be scientists. And that means you'll have to do a lot of work on those podcasts, Tom.
You just have to go to the Bodleian.
Well, I won't know what it means.
So when the exam you did when you were 13, who was the most important person?
I wonder if I could find... Hold on. I've made a mistake. I've made a terrible mistake.
What?
It wasn't the... it was the most important dates in world history.
Okay. So what date, what was the most important date?
They're all British. They're literally all
British.
Nothing
wrong with that.
I've also misspelt Britain throughout. So the very first date is AD 43, Tom.
That's a very important date.
The conquest of Britain, as I call it, by Claudius and the Romans, which left us the Roman heritage and culture. Yeah. The next date is just the Dark Ages. It says the bringing of Christianity to Britain by St. Augustine, which made us a Christian country.
Oh.
And it goes on and on. Do you know what the last date is?
No.
So I did 26. I've got the top 26 dates. And so I've done them alphabetically. This is at the age, it must be 12 and a half. And it says, so Z is 1982. The victory by Britain in the Falklands War, which saved the Falkland Islands from Argentinian domination.
The young patriot.
Yeah.
So no woke tosh there.
But what about this one? The 1970s, the loss of the Vietnam War by the USA, which taught them they did not rule the world as they seemed to think, and they wait for it, and they couldn't push other countries such as Britain around.
Oh dear. The child is father to the man.
The winning of World War II by Britain and some allies. Which saved the world from German domination. Yeah.
So your children's books. This is the template, isn't it?
Right, exactly. I just reproduced those answers. Exactly.
Well, so on the topic of Britain,
yeah,
there's a very good question from Three Bottle Man. On the back of the questions, I have one. Which nation have been the most brutal colonizers in history?
This is an excellent question, and I thought about this when I saw it. So the paradigmatic example that people often give, would you agree, Tom, is Belgium?
I was about to say Syria.
I mean, the Belgian Congo is often held up, isn't it, as the absolute kind of...
The Romans were very brutal.
I mean, I think the truth of the matter is it's a slightly... I think clearly all nations have it in them to be incredibly... And I think the only difference between those who have and those who haven't is basically, you know, did they have the possibility? Not did they have the will, or did they have the... Because I think all nations ultimately at various points have had the will to dominate their neighbours. They've not had the capability to do it. So I don't think it's a moral judgment so much as just a contingent one. What do you think? Or do you think some nations have genuinely been more brutal than others?
I think the level of brutality in the ancient world was, I mean, breathtaking.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that said, I've just been reading, Anthony Beaver has a book about the Russian Civil War, which I'm reviewing in the Sunday Times. and the gruesomeness of that book, you know, the horrendous massacres, and this is, you know, 1920s, are off the scale. They're absolutely off the scale. And if and I think that book alone, and there, of course, there are so many others that could be written about the first half of the 20th century, about Vietnam or the Iran-Iraq War or Yugoslavia. Well,
I mean, the Nazis in the East are colonizers, right, aren't they?
All of those things are most stunning rebukes to the idea that we've got better as we've progressed, I think. Or when people say, oh, medieval levels of barbarism.
I think that, we discussed this in the Game of Thrones episode, that you'd rather live under medieval laws of war than early modern ones.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you definitely would.
And you definitely wouldn't want to live in Eastern Europe during 1914 to...
No.
Just horrible. Awful. I think we could come back to that.
Were you not tempted by Velo Vicar, Barney de Berry's thing about... when we were talking about cancelling people, and he was very keen that we bring back the idea of original sin.
I completely agree.
That allows us to... I agree too. I think I've said this so many times to people outside, you know, sort of conversation. If you just assume that all the statues are of flawed people...
Then fine, isn't it?
That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't go to... When I walk around, I don't know, Ljubljana, I don't think to myself, oh God, these people must be saints, then the people here must revere them. I mean, just assume they're all people.
All awful. On the topic of Dan Carlin's thing, there's one, I'm going to quote a tweet, because it was a shocking tweet.
I know what it is.
And it's by somebody called Nicolaus de Missouria.
Yeah.
Who's obviously...
He's a classicist, isn't he, Tom? In Texas.
I think he's so wrong on so
many
levels.
In Austin, Texas.
Listening to the two newest Restless History episodes has solidified my opinions about Dominic as it compared to Tom. One, Dominic's voice is more mellifluous. Two, he writes better questions.
Well,
I'm not... Absolute scenes, as you say.
It's not... I'm not qualified to judge on mellifluousness or otherwise of voices. But you rebuked me about my choice of questions.
I did. I said that they were exam questions. And I was wrong, and I'm prepared to accept that I was wrong.
I think we had a great mix of questions. Yeah. I thought some were frivolous and ridiculous, and some were penetrating and profound.
Because the aim was to cover as many episodes of hardcore history as we possibly could. So we wanted to touch the base of all Dan's various episodes and interests and so on. So that was basically the thinking.
Yeah, I thought the mix of questions were really well, actually. And I think we both agreed that we'd really love to do that format
with other people. Yeah, so if you've got suggestions for people who you'd like to hear that kind of discussion, let us know.
I know some people are very keen on the polls, the pie chart-based polls on the Discord channel.
Yes.
By the way, the producer said that we should encourage everybody to go onto the Discord channel, have more chats. Not that you're not having enough chats, but you could have even more.
I was away for a few days and came back, and it seemed there was quite enough chat.
Right, now talking of chat, let's have the feedback to our bonus episode, Tom. So, Arena says, do we really have a worse cultural denunciation than, say, McCarthy-era America or East Germany that is most repressive? Isn't our culture largely more forgiving in that we're not conducting a state-backed witch hunt, but rather employing public shaming? So, yeah, they're not quite analogous, are they? So when people say, oh, this is like the culture of McCarthyism or the Stasi or something, when they're talking about kind of cancel culture, and they're obviously not the same at all, because I think one of the interesting things about cancel culture is that it's absolutely not sort of state-driven or externally driven.
No.
It's within relatively small groups, I would say, wouldn't you?
Well, I've said this before. I think the comparison is the closest comparison is with Protestantism in the 16th century. It's hot Protestants moving into universities, and the Catholics have been edged aside, and now there's a kind of arms race to prove who's the hottest Protestant.
Yes.
And you kind of get the bishop class, you suddenly think, whoa, they're trying to get rid of the vestments, trying to slam the brakes on and being denounced. I mean, I think that seems to me the closest parallel, and it's a parallel because it's bred of the same kind of impulses, I think.
And yet the funny thing is, of course, when you make this, a lot of people get very cross, don't they? The sort of the people involved themselves get absolutely furious. So I think there were some people who were very cross that we had because the whole issue of the Anglo-Saxons, which we talked about last time, which is basically the gift that never stops giving, as far as we're concerned, and that some, I mean, I don't want to completely sound like a man at the golf club bar, but some lunatic in America will make some ridiculous pronouncement about how the Anglo-Saxon, all uses of the word Anglo-Saxon should be eradicated forthwith. Tom then gives a gives an interview to the Sunday Times, which he says something very mild.
So this got picked up in the Sunday Times last Sunday, and they went through my tweets and quoted them. the reaction wasn't altogether, I mean, it wasn't necessarily positive. Let's say one academic responded, described me in a very Anglo-Saxon manner.
They did. They talked of you as Rebecca Vardy has spoken of Colleen Rooney.
Yes. So used an Anglo-Saxon word, or I should say an early English word.
Yeah, the irony.
And talking of reactionary golf club bores, Sarah Carey says, on writing for the Daily Mail, I think it's a noble and grounding to exercise the right for a popular paper.
So she's right.
She's a columnist and actually writing for real people and not the intelligentsia or lefties. It's both enjoyable and worthwhile.
Well, she's absolutely right. I mean, completely right, obviously.
Be proud, Dominic, Sarah says.
I struggle, as you know, Sarah, with very low self-esteem. So
sometimes you wake in the middle of the night wondering,
I do.
Will I ever come out with a reactionary?
I never worry about that, Tom.
It's come to me.
I don't think that well will ever run dry.
And then one last on this topic, Comeback Zinc. These ridiculous academic spats on Twitter, always much more about jockeying over money and status than anything else, are great at reminding me why being a historian would actually be awful. That said, there is definitely a gap in the market for my book, The Very Dark Ages, why the Middle Ages were terrible, nothing good happened, and people lived in mud like in the Monty Python.
Comeback Zinc is right about two things. One, I think the issue there is not actually whether being a historian would be awful, but actually whether being
a medievalist,
an academic in certain environments, you know, in particular subjects where you're sort of looking over your shoulder.
I don't think particularly in America.
Oh, yeah.
The issues at debate there seem so much more.
They've sort of been poisoned by the sort of toxic racial politics of America, haven't they? Do you not think that's now there's a culture of sort of moral stridency, which doesn't really translate across the Atlantic. I mean,
except that there are academics who are so desperate to be American.
Yeah.
You know, to Cliff Richard.
They started using the sort of abbreviation BIPOC.
Yes.
Did you see that?
I don't think indigenous means...
Indigenous.
In Britain, because in Britain, the people who use the word indigenous all tend to be on the far right.
Unless they're very, very, very keen Celticists, I suppose. Comeback Zinc is also right, though. The trend now to say that the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages were actually a time of absolute enlightenment and bubbling fountains is so great that the really subversive and radical book would be one that said
they were terrible. You
know, the Dark Ages were really dark.
Well, but you do still get those. Absolutely, you still get those. You still it's often from the perspective of people who are hostile to religion.
Oh,
so you
I see.
Definitely still get the recycling of the kind of Edward Gibbon.
So Catherine Nix's book about
Catherine Nixie would be the classic example. Yeah, it was all terrible, evil Christians, you know.
Evil Christians smashing statues.
If they hadn't destroyed the Library of Alexandria, we'd all be on Alpha Centauri by now.
who did the book about the decline of Rome, fall of Rome a few years ago?
Brian Ward Perkins.
He thinks the Dark Ages are really dark, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Do you think the Dark Ages, you don't think the Dark Ages were dark though, do you?
I think it depends who you are. I think if you're a senator and you have international, you know, business interests and estates all over the empire, then it's terrible. And essentially, you know, your kind of central heating goes and it's awful. But I think that if you're subjective to the very, very oppressive state apparatus of the late Roman Empire, I think that its collapse would be something quite welcome.
If you're a Merovingian warlord.
I think the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries were pretty grim.
Why 8th, 9th, 10th?
Because you're being attacked by Vikings and by Arabs.
Right.
And I think, I mean, particularly in the Mediterranean, the depredations of Arab slavers in that period was horrendous. kind of on a scale with Roman slaving depredations. So two great periods of imperial expansion, the expansion of the Roman Empire and the Caliphate through the Mediterranean was terrible news.
Am I not right in thinking as well? I just recently finished my children's book on the Vikings. And in the course of my sort of reading for that, there's an argument that the European economy kind of reboots partly because of the slave trade is one of the things that really reboots the European economy after the fall of the Roman Empire.
Yes. It's a book called The Origins of the European Economy, Communications and Commerce, AD 300 to 900 by Michael McCormick. And I recommend it unreservedly. It's a paradigm shifting book.
And he basically says slavery is the motor. Is it?
Yes, because particularly Latin Europe is, it's equivalent to the Third World, to the Caliphate, which has taken over the heartlands of civilization, is vastly wealthier. And so the money that gets paid for slaves starts to percolate, particularly through Italy.
Yeah.
And so you get Venice and Amalfi and so on. And then it starts to kind of percolate out. It's a really, really wonderful book. I mean, kind of sobering and depressing.
I think I told you before on this podcast about how when we went on holiday to the Swedish island of Gotland, where they have the most, in their museum, they have the most amazing, I mean, thousands upon thousands of Islamic coins, silver. And it's great. And it's always sort of seen as, oh, this is lovely multiculturalism and, you know, globalization and all the rest of it. But actually what people don't, you know, like to think about is that all that silver came through, you know, it was paying for slaves.
So on the topic of multiculturalism, as though it's inherently a good thing, that the ultimate multicultural activity in the early 10th century is absolutely the slave trade, which to the degree that it's left its mark on the English language, because you have the Etonian Knights, the Franks in what becomes Germany, expanding eastwards, taking Slavs to be slaves, right. So that Servi become Slavi, mm-hmm. And they then get taken to Verdun, where you have Jewish doctors who will castrate the boys, and then they'll all be taken and sold to the Caliphate. And this is the only real kind of multicultural activity that's going on. And it's, you know, it's a depressing business.
Yeah. Oh, how do we get onto this? Talking about the Dark Ages.
So we've got some general chat, haven't we?
Yeah, the general chat. GT Avalado asks, why haven't we had a This Is Your Life episode for Tom? We will do. We absolutely will do. A live stream.
Was there not a feeling that it was a bit self-indulgent?
Yeah, well, there probably was a bit of that. And I think, but we thought that for that reason, we wouldn't do it straight away. We'd just do them every now and again kind of thing. Well, we're going to really do them once each, can't we? Unless we bring in.
We could just do it again and just make it up.
Yeah. Hector has a question for you, Tom. Would you know the origins in the ancient world of the notion of the swan song and what's it all about? What is the swan song?
It's the idea that the swan dies and it sings a beautiful song as it dies. And it was scoffed at by Pliny the Elder.
Really?
It was one of the things he didn't believe.
Well, that's because generally he believed a lot, didn't he?
Believe a lot. To be scoffed at by Pliny is pretty shameful.
Okay. But do you know where it came from originally?
So the swan is a bird that was sacred to Apollo, who was the god of music. So
that's probably why. Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe Hector, if he has other information, can enlighten us. So let's end with Amy Mantravadi. She is very keen to know about, Tom, are you where do you stand in relation to Harry Potter? Were your girls they're the right age for Harry Potter.
They didn't like it.
They didn't like it?
No, and I thought, surely they'll like it. And so Eliza was telling me that I'd been very rude to her in saying, you've got to read it. And so she refused to read it.
That's always the way, though, because kids, there comes a point where they just refuse to read what you give them.
So they never watched it, or I don't really know.
They never read it.
No.
Right. Because
wasn't for want of trying.
It's interesting, because Arthur, he started on an audiobook when we were in America, driving around New England. When he was about six, and he wouldn't get out of the car. He was so hooked by it. You know, he was absolutely riveted. And I had previously been sort of slightly sniffy about J.K. Rowling, but I saw firsthand the power that her...
The spell, exactly.
So, Tom, you know the houses in Hogwarts. You know of them. You know what they are.
I do. I can't remember which ones are which.
So Gryffindor is the brave. That's Harry and co. There's Ravenclaw, who are clever. Hufflepuff, who are kind. And Slytherin, who are cool.
Slytherin is the evil one, isn't it?
Yeah, Slytherin is the evil one. So let's start with me. They had a vote among the Wangs, which house I would be in. And by quite a substantial margin, they voted that I would be in Hufflepuff.
So that's a nice one.
Yeah, which is kind, but perhaps slightly dull. Kind of loyal, generous. But the thing
No offense, Dominic. That's but that seems quite odd.
No, because do you know what? Well, on J.K. Rowling's website, Pottermore, you can do a very, very complicated questionnaire, which my son insisted that we all do. Mm. And that placed the other members of my household in Ravenclaw, the clever house, but it placed me in Hufflepuff. So
because you're,
there's no
because
arguing
you're so nice. Because you're so
because
nice.
Because actually I think people see the heart of gold. I think that's what it is.
That's extraordinary.
And then you.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty tight between the four. But the winner was Gryffindor, which is Harry Potter's house.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, but it's kind of a bit bland and predictable, I think. Second place was Ravenclaw. And then Slytherin.
And then Hufflepuff last. So I'm just not nice. I'm just a horrible person.
I think people often see that virtue signal is just terrible people. People who do a lot for charity and stuff talk a lot about their charity work, but often utter monsters in real life.
Yes.
But I think that's what people have cottoned on to.
Yeah, that must be it. Whereas people who just kind of grump around
are actually really kind.
Just
hot. Like Badger in the Wind in the Willows.
I say, now, having been Owl, you're now Badger as well.
Yeah, I'm basically the animal kingdom in human form.
Well, you're the kind of the patriarchal figures in all these children's stories.
Yeah. That's nice, though, isn't it? It's nice to be a patriarchal figure. Abraham-type figure. Right, listen, we should talk about what we're going to be doing. So we have just recorded today a special...
Right Royal Jubilee episode.
A Jubilee episode with a lady from Sotheby's.
Confusingly called Christy.
Yes, it's called Christy, because Sotheby's have got a big exhibition of artifacts to do with the Queen and the Jubilee and stuff. So we recorded with her talking about her exhibition. I think we were probably a little more lighthearted than she was expecting, because we're not natural royal watchers. I think it's fair to say, Tom.
It's got some musical interludes, hasn't it?
It has some two excellent musical interludes, for which you are wholly responsible. We're going to be recording an episode about George Orwell. We're going to be recording an episode about tied in. Nobody outside Australia will know that this is happening, though Australians undoubtedly will, that there's an Australian election. And so we're subjecting the leaders of Australia to the same treatment
that we've given to the presidents of France and the chancellors of Germany.
Yep. And I think that's going to be enormously good fun with lost trousers and strange drownings and just all kinds of shenanigans. And we've got Dunkirk coming up, haven't we? We've got Dunkirk and we've got...
And this Saturday, of course, we've got the Athelstan party.
Oh, that's very exciting. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
Looking forward to coming all the way down.
I am. I've got your country lair. Yeah. Coming out my lair. For the Athelstan party, then I'm doing your charity do, Tom.
On Monday.
So I'm coming out, twice.
Which reflects, that's exactly why you're in Hufflepuff.
Exactly.
So kind.
I'm doing it for nothing. I'm not being recompensed in any way, which is disappointing.
Well, you're doing it so that you can know you're doing good.
Exactly. And with every passing day, as I look at my diary, the rest is history's episode about pigeons.
Yes. The windscreen of fate. The pigeon dropping of destiny.
Yeah.
Doomed to meet.
I keep looking at my diary and seeing this word, pigeons, written for one day. Thinking,
so exciting.
I still haven't scratched that out. Why have we not scratched that out? Because it clearly is going to happen now.
It's going to be the best episode of the year.
Yeah. So, on that bombshell, we will. Oh yeah, no, we've got to tell them about something. We've got to tell them about our book club.
Yes.
So we were thinking that we would do a Restless History book club, but we have completely failed to do anything about it. And completely coincidentally, some of you have set up the book club yourselves, haven't you? The Restless History book club, it's based on Discord. It's run by the members themselves. Some enthusiasts have set up their own book club, and they are going to read a book every month, sometimes fiction, but mainly nonfiction. All you'd have to do is join that thread, I think, on the Discord. And people can discuss what book they're going to read, and they have a poll, and they vote, and then they announce the winner, and then you read the book, and they only have a chat on Discord once or twice a month about how you're getting on with it and all that kind of thing. So it says if you miss a month, if you join late, or if you can't finish the book, that's fine. It's a chilled out space, it says.
For learning, talking, and sharing our love of history.
That sounds very nice. Are you going to join that, Tom? You've got a book of your own to write, haven't you? So I'm just being mean.
Have I mentioned that?
No, never, never. This is a revelation to people. Yeah. No, I think it's a great thing.
Do you know, I'm really looking forward to reading stuff.
It's not relevant to your...
That isn't directly relevant to either the book or a podcast.
Yeah. You'll never be able to read stuff that's not relevant to a podcast, though, will you?
Oh, I might be able to read, you know, a novel or something.
Yeah, I know. I know exactly what you mean, actually.
Or a book on science, Dominic.
Oh, don't do that. That would be very disappointing.
I've got all these books on dinosaurs.
It's not science, though. That's nature. I think that's nature. I don't think that's science.
Right. Oh, there was a question, wasn't there? Who should do... I think there could be an audience for the rest of science. Which dynamic duo should present? What would the Wangs of science be called?
Bores.
Dominic. I think Adam Rutherford would be very good on that.
My sister-in-law is very keen to do the Restless Heritage. She'd love to do a Restless Heritage.
Oh, the Restless Churches.
The Restless Churches, exactly. Something of that ilk. On that note, I think we will say goodbye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.